extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here!
Oh, from New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time. I am Andrew Wiebe with my partners in soccer, Matt Doyle, David Goss. He's tan, he's relaxed, he has that honeymoon glow. Big show today coming up, the best things we saw, big embrace. In Toronto, John Herdman, Lorenzo Insigne are getting along and getting points. The Greek god of goals gets his first MLS hat trick. We've got stoppage time goals in Orlando, Columbus, Austin, and New York City, plus squeegees in Philadelphia and much more. The extra time man of the match day goes to, we don't know yet, but I nominate Laurent Courtois and Coke Rose Mustache. And for That's Whack, hello, New York City once again, as well as the Chicago Fire. Plus, former MVPs and a current MVP candidate signed long-term extensions. Hani, Heal, Denny Bawanga, and the Timbers are closing in on a striker, lovingly nicknamed Littlehead because he has a big one. Plus, we're going to look ahead to the CONCACAF Champions Cup round of 16 deciders. What's up, guys? That was a lot.
That was a lot, but you did it. You got, like, that was, it was very professionally done. Good rhythm, and you even worked in the fact that David is coming back to us tanned. And
do I look tan? I don't think you don't really look
as tanned as I expected, but you look refreshed.
That's a lie too.
You look like you just got off an 18-hour flight.
You're haggard.
I took every form of transportation that has ever existed just to get back to you guys. I was so desperate to get back to you both and Anders that I just seaplanes, cars, mopeds, trains, everything just to get back to you guys.
Canoes, self-propelled vehicles of all types. What kind of resort person are you? You're on the islands. We won't say which islands. It's safety concerns, obviously. But what kind of resort? Are you the same drink for 2 weeks straight? Are you the same chair, creature of habit, relaxation only? Or are you bothering people to like go on excursions and do things that normal people might not want to do?
Doyle, you're a resort vet, right? Like that's your vacation?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. This was new for me. We were a little bit of everything. I think I'm a little too antsy for resort life. It was amazing for a honeymoon, and that's why we did it. But like, it's, you know, you're like, oh, what, checking the time. I mean, we went from happy hour to happy hour. I'm a professional happy hour attendee, but it's a lot of late. I read a bunch of books, read a good book about the Ottoman Empire that I will send you.
Ooh, that's for me.
As well, I did some scuba diving. So I dove with manta rays, which is crazy. Some sea turtles, some sharks, a lot of snorkeling. But that feels like a lot of activity for a resort, right? Like me saying all that sounds ridiculous.
That's the right way to do it, right? Okay. Because if I'm going to a resort for 8 days, two or three of them are like do nothing days. And the rest of them, you're going out fishing. You're going to go hiking somewhere. I don't love scuba diving, but I'll do it. You know, that sort of like there's an activity or two every day for five of the 8 days. You did it right.
Okay. Listen to this elite that we're dealing with. I don't like scuba diving, but I'll do it. I'll do it. All right. If you force me to do it in a tropical area, I guess I'll jump in the water.
You know what? I would not do it if there were sharks there.
I agree.
I would not have gone into the ocean in an area where I am not explicitly at the top of the food chain. And it sounds like you were willing to do that, David. So congratulations.
I wasn't totally notified of what was going on. It was specifically explained to me that the sharks were more scared of me because they were small black tip reef sharks. And then when we went diving outside of the resort, they were not black tip reef sharks. They were tiger sharks and white tip sharks, which are not scared of me. And that was not how it was explained to me until I rose to the surface. And I was like, whoa, that was way bigger than the sharks I saw at the resort. And they're like, yeah, well, that one's a tiger shark. And you're like, oh, well, where does that sit on the food chain? And they're like, no, they're pretty big. Then the guy says to me, you know, I went diving with sharks one time, bleeding by accident, and they only care about fish blood. They'll never attack you. And you're like, that feels like the type of thing that isn't true, and I don't trust you anymore.
Yeah, your personal experiences may or may not apply to me. That's kind of, he's like, hey, if you die, you die. Like, don't worry about it. Just hope you're not bleeding here. You want to get into it, guys? Let's talk MLS. Best thing you saw? You've been spending all day, Dave. I know. Camped in front of the television, kept catching up on match day 4. Where does that leave you? What's the best thing you saw?
There was a lot of good stuff this weekend. There was a lot of dramatic finishes, which I think was sort of the fun part. And not watching it live, but sort of catching up, you're like, oh my God, that's like the last game and the previous game and the game before. But I got to give hat tip to the gaffer himself, Phil Neville, Fizza, with the one touch clean into a teammate's hands to go for a quick restart that led to the free kick that led to the Evander goal late on. It was past the 97th minute on the road. And yet he's got one, the touch under pressure skill check to bring it down cleanly. And then two, spurring his team on to go for the win instead of hold for the tie on the road. So that, I thought overall, the Evander goal was obviously the key moment. And the MLS MVP candidacy for Evander begins now and rolls out of the Bronx and across two countries on a continent.
This is the momentum we needed.
Yeah.
Evander has arrived.
But that touch was wild. And it's one of those moments where you're like, oh yeah, you look at like the lineup of coaches in MLS in different years, there's ballers out there. So it was fun to watch. It was a funny moment. Obviously it's been a good start to the season for them off and on. And I just love seeing the skill check anytime. Cause I'm the guy at the field who kicks the ball straight up in the air and screams skill check just to see who reacts first.
Oh, I thought he was crazy when he took that touch. Because it was, as you said, deep into stoppage time, and they had come back and, you know, equalized late, and you've done the job then. It's a point on the road. Why are you hurrying play? Like, I expected him to take that touch and, like, boot it into the third, fourth row.
Fake the touch and walk away so it bounces behind you and off into the nether regions, right?
Yeah, and the ref blows full time.
This is why I'm sitting on a show with two losers.
Right, exactly.
Championships are won by those who want it.
I will say it's
dive a natural... with sharks while bleeding. Otherwise, go.
There's a natural tendency. I don't know about you guys, but if I'm at a sporting event, if there's like a ball coming my way in the crowd, like my brain is gone. I'm diving for this thing. If there's an opportunity to like make a behind the back pass or the soccer ball rolls to you at training when I was covering teams, I'm like, okay, a little outside of the foot travella. I'm going to try to show some skill here. I just don't do what Fizzer does. I don't execute in the moments, and that is the biggest difference. Congratulations to Phil Neville. 7 points so far. How about a first win for the Rapids, Doyle? Does that rise to the level of best thing you saw?
It does, and not because it was a particularly beautiful game, and I'm not a Colorado Rapids fan or anything like that. I'm a fan of rivalries. I thought the best story of last year was St. Louis and Kansas City just instantly having this blood feud that became one of the best rivalries in MLS in year one. Colorado and RSL used to have that, and it's been a long, long time. This has been so one-sided in RSL's favor that it, like, I hesitate to even call the Rocky Mountain Cup a rivalry anymore. It just like permanently resides in Sandy. So for Colorado to go to that stadium, and I thought they executed okay. Like, they weren't great. There are still some things I'm questioning with regard to their shape, and I think Georgi Mihailovic's numbers, sort of underlying numbers in terms of touches, passes into the final third, they were a little bit better than the eye test. Like, he was probably more involved than it felt like. So I'm not saying that everything is right and that everything is working, but they got a 2-1 win against what is nominally their rivals. And I'm hoping that this spurs some sort of life, gives some sort of life to this derby, because it needs it, because it's been all claret and cobalt for so long. So well done, Rapids. Well done, Chris Armas, getting your first job, your first win on this job, and hopefully more to come, including, you know, if you're an RSL player, coach, fan, you now have the return leg circled, because they came to your house and they got 3 points.
After four wins for RSL last year, that was the context that Armas was looking at, and no wins in two. Now he has his first. Sometimes you need a little bit of belief. Toronto FC definitely have some belief. The best thing I saw is Lorenzo Insigne and John Herdman in a, what's the right adjective here? Like, warm, intimate, I don't know, an embrace that you would never expect. Like, all last year, it was Lorenzo Insigne and Bernadeschi, and they're vaping here, and they're arguing this coach there, and they can't get on the same page, and they don't like each other. And now Insigne scoring bangers, Toronto are winning, and he and Herdman are coming together for what's the right word, Anders? Help me out here. What did they do on the sideline? Was it a embrace? Yes, it was an embrace on the sideline. What a moment that was. What a win it was for Toronto.
It's so hard for you to call that an embrace.
Oh, just because Anders was in the chat. Anders was in the chat. Yeah, I know.
And they hugged.
I know. Anders is just yelling at me in the chat.
Depth call it an embrace. Emotion for Weeby that he feels in watching it. Look, embrace isn't poetry. A strong enough word. He needs a word to be created to explain the relationship. Because I don't know if you've heard, but John Herdman and Lorenzo Insigne are children of fathers. And when you talk about fathers and you're talking about Andrew Weeby, you have to have more.
No, you're right. There was an element. There was a familial element there. I don't know if it was father-son necessarily, but you know, maybe two fathers who love their sons who were bonding over that moment. I don't know. We could debate this for hours. Some other things that I saw that were the great things in the league, but not the best. Apparently, Christian Benteke, who did not travel, this is according to Steve Goff at the Washington Post, Benteke somehow found his way to Cincinnati on his own, and to the surprise of everyone, was sitting on the team bus on Sunday when the players boarded it before the match. Christian Benteke, ultimate teammate. Love that.
That's pretty
love
awesome. That like if you're one of the young guys on that team, and they finished, I think, with three teenage homegrowns. Well, one is actually a draft pick, Jacob Merle, but like he's a local kid. Right, he grew up rooting for DC United. So the three local kids, and then Jackson Hopkins, another teenaged homegrown, started. And you see the highest paid player on the team, the best player on the team, a guy who has won a lot in Europe and with Belgium, being that bought in to what the team is doing this year. Like that, to me, that's leadership. That's exactly what you want from your DP. And if you're Troy Lessain, the head coach, you're probably over the moon at what Benteke is modeling there, and then also what Matthias Klick, the other veteran DP on this roster, how like his intensity level through three games this year, I think, has ratcheted up compared to what we saw last year. And he was pretty good last year, but it's a different player this year. Speaks well to the culture that they have tried to build and instill. And it's very early days, and all of this can go wrong. It's usually gone wrong for DC over the past 10 years. But it was nice to see.
Troy Lessain should be on this show later this week. Another chat. Dave and I will talk to him and see what's going on in DC. By the way, Bongi, the troll job, did you see this on the game-winning goal? Like, oh, that's all great. But Bongi takes his shirt off in front of the Orlando supporters section, turns it around, shows them the back of it, and doesn't just stand there. He lingers. And keeps lingering. It's like a 2-minute period of Bongi staring people in the face who are giving him double birds, literally from like 5 feet away, and just showing him the back of the jersey. It was an amazing moment as Bongi returns and the Loons fly. They keep flying. And last but not least, the squeegee game in Philadelphia, man, that field's progression was insane. If you haven't seen this, Jonathan Tanwald tweeted the like, okay, here I was watching before. Here are still photographs as it progresses and turns into a literal swimming pool. It was incredible and obviously not playable. That game has been postponed to a later date. All right, man of the match day. Who would you like to nominate, Dave? Do the honors. Have you been around for a man of the match day yet?
Let's say no.
Okay, we say no. It's a new bit for you. Who would you nominate? Who's your man of the match day?
But I can do anyone associated. It doesn't have to be a player.
Could be anybody.
I'm going to say John Herdman.
Okay.
Am I allowed to go back? You're allowed. Quote-unquote embrace?
You can embrace John Herdman as your man of the match day. By the way, we had some email on this. Mark from the 6, I'm assuming the 6, because the subject line was, quote, okay, I'm drunk. That was 6:21 p.m. Eastern on Saturday. And it starts with, I meant to complain earlier, but here you are. No, here you are, Mark from the 6. You had a section about new coaches winning, but you did not mention John Herdman. But we had 446 hours of Messi. Anyway, today, 3 games, 0 goals allowed, 7 points, and Lucas Watts hit us up and said, this man joined the team last year and just sat in the stands and watched the disaster class. He must have put in some work because what he's cooking up right now is special. Nice. John Herdman, man, he's inspirational.
Lucas Watts referencing back to the Josie Altidore cooking something up in the kitchen in Toronto.
I know.
Back to the great moments. we didn't know who John Herdman would be as a club manager. And I don't 100% feel like I still do of what are his, like, where is his philosophy? What does he want to do? What does he want to create? But he has gotten results this year with a very similar team than last year that they weren't capable of doing. And when you watch them play, I think going back to the Insigne part, like you mentioned Insigne's embrace with him, there's a moment early on where Bernadeschi sets up Kobe Franklin, who kind of whiffs on his shot. And Insigne comes over and like hugs him and pats him on the head. And he's talking to him. And I think you just see overall the environment with this group, what you see, I think, in terms of finding space for Insigne to affect the game. Right now, you have the back three. You have Petretta, who can play out wide and can push out wide, allow Insigne to float across the middle, or it can allow Insigne to go out wide. Petretta stays tight, and then the right wing back can push higher up the field, and they can rotate through midfield to fill in the spaces. So I think what we saw from Canada, and he tried to do with Alphonso Davies a lot, maybe I thought to the detriment of Davies, who isn't the same type of player, was just giving freedom to your best players to affect the game as much as possible. And right now, they have enough of a structure to what they're doing that those players can take risks and try and do things and know that one loss of the ball here or there doesn't mean that the team's going the other way and giving up a goal. So it's an impressive start for a very similar team. And that was the fear. Now, they made some big signings late on in the transfer window, but those players have not trained with this group. So you still have Gomis and Long figuring it out as they go. And with Larea injured, my big fear about this group was the lack of depth. Like, they just have no other options in the team. To lose Larea and still win a game is a pretty big deal.
Somebody's got to finish toward the bottom of the table. As Jim Curtin said on a call last week, somebody's got to finish last in the Eastern Conference. That truly is going to be a dogfight, both at the top and the bottom. But right now, Toronto FC giving themselves some breathing room when a lot of people looking at our entire podcast here figured they'd be down at the bottom based on the vibes last year. How about Laurent Courtois? Let's keep it in Canada. I'm going to nominate Laurent. I'm going to nominate Sam Piet, the captain as well, for Montreal. 8 points away all last year. 7 points away in their first three matches, including going to Miami, I know without Messi, and winning 3-2 in a dramatic, crazy game. Courtois is not playing Nancy ball, which you know if you listen to this podcast or read Doyle or just watch the games. It's much deeper. It's much more conservative, let's say, in high leverage possession moments in the middle of the field. Like, they're more likely to recover and get into shape than they are to try to push the issue at all times. But this team's finding opportunities in transition. They're choosing the right 5 to 10 minute stretches to ratchet up the pressure and the intensity, and they're getting results so far. And to go to what the Rapids have, this power of belief is going to be so powerful for Courtois, because I really think he's only put in like half the playbook, so to speak, in football terms. Like, there is going to be more to this team as they get accustomed to what he wants to do and how he wants to do it, and have more time throughout the year to integrate players, to get comfortable, to make some of the mistakes that are required to say, okay, you made a mistake, but let's just keep doing it. It will pay dividends down the line. And I got to give it to Sam Piet. His ability to stitch everything together, to be the ultimate recognizer of danger, to sort of be the conscience out there of like, hey guys, it's time. Like, we've lost this ball. We're in a vulnerable position. Let's get into shape. Let's recover. Let's be in the right spaces. Let's eliminate the mistakes that killed us last year. It's been incredibly impressive from Montreal so far. So I would nominate Courtois and Sam Piet in tandem. And Doyle, that means that you have to nominate Yakumakis or the MLS Player of the Week. Truthers are going to be after you.
Yeah, I mean, and he earned it, right? If you're the number nine, your job is to score goals. And he has made no bones about, like, that is what drives him. And he put on a show against the Revs in what ultimately became a 4-1 win. I didn't think Atlanta were great for the first half. I thought they were very, very good in the second half. And Yakumakis was a big part of that. And it's because he's got that Wando thing of never switching off. And I don't think he has necessarily the same, he's not the same type of forward as Wando. And I'm not sure he's necessarily the same type of leader in the locker room yet, though I haven't heard anything bad about him in the locker room. It's just that he's always looking for the next run and the next spot, you know, bit of space in the box. He's always on his toes searching for rebounds, and it's infectious. And you could see, because of that, the Atlanta attack always has a reference point in the box, and that is that is what great goal scorers are made of. And I, you know, I was happy to see him sort of get rewarded for that, including taking a penalty, because he doesn't usually do that. So it all kind of comes to, he did take a penalty, right?
Yeah, he took the second. That was, I was going to say, Thiago Amada takes the first, and originally Yakumakis had been holding the ball on the first, right before the end of the first half that Yakumakis draws. Amada scores, Atlanta go up, they go into halftime, they have this lead to protect now. I thought it was super smart for Almada or whoever it was. If it was Pineda that said this is the way we should do it, or it was negotiated between Gigi and Almada to say, let's get the big guy going.
Yeah.
We're up 1-0. We got another penalty. You earned the last one. Get in there and finish this thing.
Yep.
That like got the ball rolling downhill. And for the Revs, who are dealing with CONCACAF Champions Cup and who had played a pretty good first half, once the ball got rolling and they had to open up and it was stretched and they were tired and their structure fell apart, that's where Atlanta just tear you apart.
And what
they did.
It's what they did. And one of the things that I like about it, and we've made this point on the show, the pieces all fit together. And in part, that's because Yakumakis is not a versatile soccer player. He's an expert at this one specific role, which is to be a center forward who leads the line by himself, right? He's not meant to play in a two. And there's no like, oh, you can actually use him on the wing and do this, that, and the other thing. It's like, no, you put him up there as the number nine in a 4-2-3-1 or a 4-3-3. And it just makes it easier on everyone around him. And that's the way the game played out in the second half, especially. And I suspect that's the way much of this year for Atlanta United is going to play out.
All right, Anders, decide for us, who is the man of the match day? Let us know when you know. As we continue on here, let's hit up CONCACAF Champions Cup, because I have to ask this question, and we'll do the full preview in a little bit. But I see the Revs, I see Orlando, I see even Miami in their big rotation. Houston's a part of this. Philadelphia have 3 draws in 3 games, still have a 1 in the league. Nashville, same story. Doyle, how much is CC a reason or a valid excuse for poor league starts? Like, can we wash away some of this early season malaise for some teams and just say, hey, it's just CCC. Other teams have done this before. They've experienced the same things. Our diagnosis is that you have the same disease and it will go away.
Yeah, I think for most teams, that is the correct approach to it. That we've seen this year after year after year. Very few teams do, Philadelphia. A couple of years ago, they made it all the way to the semifinals and they ended up on 60 points. LAFC, was it last? Yeah, last year they made it all the way to the finals and then they still ended up 50 points. Like, those are the exceptions. Teams mostly that make runs in CONCACAF Champions League, now Cup, teams mostly come out of that and struggle. And that is mostly what we're seeing. I'm not going to give everybody a mulligan. I'm concerned about the Revs. I think there are legit concerns about Orlando City, though I think they answered some of those this past weekend. I know the result ended up being bad, but I thought a lot of the shifting around of pieces they did was actually encouraging. I don't think Cincinnati is in as good shape as they were last year. But in general, all those teams can be explained by CONCACAF Champions Cup. It's just tough to log all those miles to play every 3 days for the first 6 weeks of the season. MLS teams, and like, to be fair, up until the last couple of years, even Liga MX teams, even the Giants struggled with it. Like, if you go back over the last 15 years and you look at the results in the Apertura, which is September to really August until December versus the Clausura in the regular season in Liga MX, the Liga MX CONCACAF Champions Cup teams always do better in the Apertura because there's no schedule congestion. And then in the Clausura, they tended to struggle in the regular season and only turn it on for the playoffs. So it takes a toll. And I think that's what we're seeing for most of these over the past, 3 weeks.
Is that soft, Dave? You willing to let those teams off with that excuse?
I don't know, let them off is the right term, because like the expectations should be high. I think to Doyle's point about the different teams he mentioned, there is a difference between a team that has high expectations and a high floor that you think will figure it out versus what we just talked about with Colorado, Montreal, and Toronto, which is these are teams that the variance is pretty high and the little bit of confidence might be the difference at the early part of the year of being competitive and not. And so you look at some of the teams in this conversation and that's where you worry about them, like a Revs team. We don't know where the Revs are going to fall. We feel fairly confident where FC Cincinnati will fall. And when you talk about LAFC and Philly the last few years, that was the case, right? Those were MLS Cup contending, Supporters Shield contending teams coming into the year. And as hard as things were with CONCACAF competition, they still got there. But that's not the conversation right now about a Nashville or a Houston or an Orlando or some of these other teams, New England as well. And so I don't know how many points are there for them to afford to give away. Where like for Columbus, if they drop a couple points in the next few weeks because they make a legitimate CONCACAF run, okay, they have that credential to them. They won MLS Cup last year. They've done it before as this group. You have belief that getting towards the end of the year, they will figure it out and they will get there. I think that's the issue for some of these teams, and it's off and on depending on which team it is. And I think for a lot of these groups, they're not as settled as we thought they'd be. And so they don't have the ability to go into their depth and get results because they don't really have cohesive styles at the top end. That's where an Orlando is scary, because they do return a lot of pieces. They do have a good core. They added to it with veterans, not young pieces, in Nico Ladero and Muriel, who will take a little bit of time, fine, coming to a new league, but you have Duncan McGuire returning. That's where I think you can be frustrated if you're some fan bases. But overall, I accept the fact of like, it is really hard to compete across these different competitions. And if you're a Miami, your focus is going to be the fact that you are steps away from deep knockout rounds in that competition, but it does take away the ability to win a Supporters Shield. Because for teams that aren't in this, they're going to be able to start to put up points while you're still figuring it out.
That's where there's no excuses for the teams that aren't in Champions Cup this year. And there are more MLS teams than ever before. If you're not one of those teams, you have all the excuses in the world of, hey, we just came out of preseason, we're trying to figure it out together. And oh, by the way, we were probably not among the elite teams last year because we didn't make this competition. But to start slow while the CCC teams start slow as well, that's just wasting your advantage. Where I will give the Revs a little bit of a pass is just on time to prep. Like Atlanta had 2 weeks. They're just sitting back, watching match day three, training, scouting, preparing. New England had maybe 1 day, 2 days to figure things out. And they've done that over and over and over throughout the year. And oh, by the way, they're changing. Caleb Porter's trying to switch up what they're doing from, you know, a little bit, let's say, a freer approach to more positional play. And they maybe don't have the right pieces in midfield right now for the time being. But you're right. Orlando, we expected them to be able to compete everywhere, to have the depth, the quality, all those things. Right now, it's not happening. So let's do this. Buy or sell? Are you buying a hot start or selling a slow start? Are you buying Minnesota, Doyle? 3-2. Bongi. Cameron Knowles, it's all going well. By the way, Cameron Knowles got the permanent assistant job with Eric Ramsey, who arrives this week. So if you're wondering about that after the interview with Khaled Al-Ahmad, they've signed that deal. You buy in Minnesota?
I'm buying them being good. I picked them fourth in preseason, and I think that is about their ceiling. They need to be better at defensive midfield. I thought Will Trapp had a real tough one in this game. Kervin Arriaga coming back might help in that regard. I have questions about how Emmanuel Reynoso, who is like my second favorite player in the league, about how he's going to fit in this defensive scheme. But I think the floor is somewhere at least in the postseason. So how about that for straddling the fence? Somewhere between fourth and eighth in the Western Conference.
How does Reynoso fit into this style that Al-Ahmad sort of outlined for us, which doesn't necessarily feel like a style, like collective? It's not always Reynoso's way.
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I don't worry about it in terms of attack. I think he would juice the attack, which has already been very good. But they they need everybody in that midfield to contribute at a pretty high level defensively if they're going to play the way they say they want to play. And Will Trapp is not the type of defensive midfielder who covers a ton for guys who maybe aren't carrying their weight elsewhere. So it might be an issue of Reynoso getting back and Minnesota having more talent because of that, but a worse collective because the pieces don't all fit together quite as well as they should. And it's going to be a fascinating thing to watch over the next month or so, whenever it is Reynoso comes back from this injury, because if he is able to hold up his end of the bargain in terms of defense, or if Eric Ramsey is willing to, and Khalid El Ahmad, because this does come from the CSO on down, if they are able to sort of adjust their expectations in terms of their game model, and it does all fit, then maybe fourth as a ceiling is a little bit too low. Because a fully happy and fit and functional Reynoso is an MVP caliber player in this league. And we've seen MVP caliber number 10s drive teams that are otherwise maybe aren't that impressive on paper to incredible heights.
Teemu Pukki, 2 goals, off to a nice start. 12 goals since he arrived in MLS. That is second only to Cucho Hernandez in that period of time. Flip side for Orlando, Dave, it's like the XG derby. It's a shooting gallery. They're just not hitting anything. Afterwards, Martino Hayda described it as a sadness, and Oscar Preja was definitely going through his feels. There was a scuffle after this game as well about how much they had created and how little they got from that. Oh, and oh, by the way, the defensive errors and goalkeeping errors were massive too. I think I was saying that Orlando would win the East. I had them in the Shield race for sure. Where did you have them, and are you ready to sell, or is this a hold and you'll be laughing down the line?
I think I'm the wrong person to ask, because I think this is a hold for me, because I think I had them pretty low. Now you got to ask me to go back and find my previews. Here we go. Seventh was where I had them.
Wow.
Preseason. They were, I already said this in the preseason segment we did about them. They are this year's Austin. I guess St. Louis could be as well. They were the big overperformers last year statistically. There's a ton of talent on this team. I trust Oscar Pereja to get performances week in and week out in MLS competition. Like, they're going to make the playoffs pretty much no matter what if they're healthy. But this was a team that I thought overperformed last year. I thought Nico Ladero was a great addition coming in, but it takes a little bit of time. And obviously, he's helped in CONCACAF already. And Muriel will take some time as well. But they have Duncan Maguire left over. There are just some deficiencies in this group, goalkeeping mistakes at times. I think as good as Jansen was, there was defensive errors last year. Now you have to bring a defender in from outside of MLS and trust that they can figure things out at a high level. And there are moments where they are easy to play against or they make these big mistakes that have been the case for years now. So it's not like shocking to see it happen. It happened at the beginning of last season. It happened all of 2022 for them. It was a large part of why it took them to the last week to make the playoffs. And it's been an issue for Orlando for a long time. So it's not shocking to me, these results. I guess therefore I'm on a hold. But at the same time, like, it wouldn't blow me away if they stole a result against Tigres. That's where they're frustrating, because the talent is so high, but I just don't think it's cohesive. I don't think that they have a clear way to dominate every game that allows them to cut off any deficiencies and work completely to their strengths.
Cesar Araujo goes off in this game hurt. He was crying. That's not a good sign. They've been dependent in their best moments, particularly at the end of last year on that two-man midfield. They just really lock down the game and eliminate opportunities for other teams in that area of the pitch. But have to figure that out now. And that last play by Minnesota, who were hanging on for dear life, just trying to get out of there with a point. The Adebayo Smith flick on. I know we're all talking about the run, the finish, the taunting, whatever you want to call that from Bongi. But that flick on is absolutely perfect. And Tenilo Oshehi already has, a goal and 2 assists in 3 games coming out of MLS Next Pro. So there are some signs for Minnesota of that culture, that depth that El Ahmad and soon-to-be Eric Ramsey are trying to build. Red Bulls, Dave, it looked like a beautiful night at Red Bull Arena. Just resort-like conditions for everyone who came.
Everyone knows the Banks of the Harrison is where you go to lay out on the beach.
Exactly. Is it just driving rain is how I would describe it. And that is a tough place to be for FC Dallas, in a place you haven't won since 2006, trying a new system with a lot of injuries, with a lot of round pegs and square holes, or whatever the saying is. You buy it on the Red Bulls, Emil Forsberg, Lewis Morgan, everybody's back, everybody's firing, and now a great defense has a productive offense, or is this just early season press?
I'm buying on the Red Bulls. I think this is who the New York Red Bulls would have been last year if Lewis Morgan was healthy and they had Emil Forsberg. Like, talent helps. There's things going on with the Red Bulls, which I think are exciting, but they have added three starters to their starting lineup that weren't in the team last year that are all better than the players they're replacing. So as much as we love to talk about culture and cohesion and tactics and style, like having a Champions League starter and a Swedish international and having Lewis Morgan, your leading goal scorer from 2 years ago, actually be capable of playing helps a ton. And I think at a minimum, you still have that floor with that back four, with Cornell, with Edelman at the base of your midfield. And with that, plus the two talents you've now re-added in Morgan and brought in Forsberg, you are better than you can be. I think there's levels for it to go. I think it's fair for Red Bulls fans over the course of this season to expect Schwartz to be able to add more in possession, to be able to create more chances for his team, maybe unlock John Tolkien even more than they already did by finding ways to protect this team when he goes forward. All of these things can add to now a conversation of a team being top four in the East. But right now, they're better than they were last year. I'm buying on it as long as these guys are healthy.
I'm buying Emil Forsberg, man. I know, Doyle, we sat on the show and we said we didn't know. Like, the minutes played for RB Leipzig hadn't been, like, the trends hadn't been great in that and production. And then you see him on the field, you see his effect on games, his vision, his composure. I mean, he even whiffed in the box on a ball he maybe should have finished, and we can sit here and say all these things.
Yeah, I mean, he's been as advertised, and it makes sense because in the history of sort of the energy drink soccer game model, which isn't that old, right? It was really only invented 15, 16 years ago. Emil Forsberg is the guy, the attacking player who has spent the most time playing like that, and he's done it at the highest level. So it's been plug and play in the most obvious way. And I agree with you 100%, Goss. Like, this is a case of the Red Bulls were good last year. They really were. They just didn't have good players in the attack. And now they have Lewis Morgan and Emil Forsberg. And oh, by the way, I think Frankie Amaya has leveled up in central midfield. He was excellent over the weekend. And then the other big piece that Weeby and I talked about last week was Noah Ayla. He has been phenomenal. And in terms of adding something to the blueprint, the ability to use the ball in certain areas and not just rely on winning 50-50s, Ayla's arguably as big an addition as Forsberg is, because he's like, the kid is already one of the best distributors at center back in the entire league. And that's just something that neither Nealis nor Reyes can really do. So it's a lot of check marks for the Red Bulls. I am absolutely buying the hot start. I am not going to buy them as cup contenders until and unless they add a young DP number nine. And I know they've been shopping for one for a couple months now. They came close on one in maybe about a month ago this time. Didn't happen. The window is still open for another 6 weeks. I'm kind of expecting them to get something done by then. I'm not guaranteeing it, but I know that they're still looking very hard and pushing very hard to add another high-level attacking piece.
Does that mean you think that Schwartz is going to go more of the 4-2-2-2 or however you want to describe it versus what we saw was like a more 4-2-3-1 here? I like the 4-2-3-1 just because it gets Lewis, Tolkien, and Forsberg in areas to combine.
I agree with you. But I think that the important thing long term is that they'll have both clubs in the bag. And if they need to go back to the 4-2-2-2, I mean, they could this coming weekend. So it's all there for this team to sort of climb back towards the summit that they were at from 2013 to 2018. And maybe even beyond.
Flip side, FC Dallas fans are a little bit frustrated right now with the transition to the 3-4-3 or however you want to describe it. A lot of teams in the league right now building with three and then two and trying to get wide players high, a lot of the Columbus Crew, and doing it to various degrees of effect. But so far, the personnel has been an issue for Nico Estevez, especially at center back, I would argue. Nicosi Tafaro is the only natural center back they're playing there. And look, if you're the Crew, that's okay. They found a way to make it work. They built belief. They keep the ball. They keep themselves ideally out of transition situations.
Yeah, they leaned on the things, which is, okay, so the clear example here is Morera and now Zawadzki at times in Odmundson versus like Ima Tumwasi and Sam Junkwa. What Wilfred Nance did was, okay, these players are really good in possession. They're really good attacking. So I'm going to build the game around their strengths and minimize their weaknesses. Ima Tumwasi defending in his own box a lot, having to turn and chase attackers, are all things he's not good at and not comfortable at. At no point are they then leaning into his strengths of this is a player who can stretch the field and attack defenders who are at a set position, maybe dribbling at pace from that right wing or right center back position. So there was no like positive to having that player out there versus the deficiencies. The other issue for this Dallas team, I think a large part of it is the central midfield, is the wing backs are so disconnected from the attacking too. Anytime they played into Paul Ariola's feet, his only option was to try and play up the line for Jesus Ferreira making the run out of midfield. It was obvious. It was predictable. And Ariola was doing it from a straight line across his back, across the back line, 35 yards from his own goal. At no point was it in attacking position. So it looks very stodgy. There's no central midfield to connect everything. Legette's trying a little bit. Fraser's not capable of it.
It's a talent issue, though, right?
Like availability?
If they had, well, I mean, that's fair.
Mendy was out.
Mendy and Pomacall are their two best central midfielders, and both guys are frequently.
Ibiaga's out. Marco Farfan, who could play that left center back position nominally, that you think that would be possible, also out. Musa has just arrived. He does not have chemistry with anybody. Logan Farrington played that center forward position against San Jose better than Musa has even come close to playing it in his two starts. I mean, it's like a lot of trying to plug him, like Giovanni Jesus is not in. So you would think that's probably your right wing back or an option. And then Ariola can go up into one of the two striker positions underneath the center forward. He's probably better to put pressure on up there. Can he play? I don't know. There's just a lot of parts that aren't fitting in the right places right now for this team and a lot of newness. And you see it every single game.
We just listed at least five players who are starters. And we're talking about a team that went on the road to a very good team and lost 2-1 in a driving rainstorm. So I think if you're a Dallas fan, I understand the frustration. I also think there needs to be some perspective on what happened this past weekend.
How about Montreal? Are you buying this? Get your money out, Dave.
How much money do I have? How many buys can I just buy?
I don't know. You tell me. You just hit that resort life. Was it all inclusive or were you paying out a drink?
No, don't worry. I've got plenty to waste now. Gotcha. I didn't spend anything over the last 2 weeks. But if I'm going to, I'm going to spend on Laurent Cuartat. I know you talked about sort of what they are and what's happened so far, playing against the ball a ton. It's just you watch them right now. And even last year, when they played under Hernan Losada, who all he talks about is pressing and closing down and playing high energy, it feels more cohesive and higher energy now against the ball than it did last year. When they close in unison. They create chances. Cocoron is working hard by himself, but the rest of the team comes with him the moment that he decides that he's going to close and press. And so you look at three road games, you look at getting results in those games against the run of play or against the ball. They wanted to do that last year and were not capable of it. So I'm buying right now on a culture and a group of players that seem bought in. They seem cohesive. I mean, to go down and do this without George Campbell is huge for this team. Like, but seriously, this was a team that I thought was going to be built on their defensive back line and the experience that they had playing together and coming back. And even in the moments where they're in possession, obviously I always talk about my boy Chouinard. But he's turning in pressure and connecting play and creating chances. Vilsant's getting the opportunities. That feels a lot like what we saw Wilfred Nancy do, telling young players, I believe in you. Here's an opportunity. I'm going to start you on the road against Inter Miami with the only game right now in the league. Everyone's watching. I'm going to put you out there because I believe in you. So I'm buying on Montreal. I'm not buying that they're back to the Nance peak of being a top two team in the East and an MLS Cup contender, but they're a legitimate playoff contender this season. And they're probably not going to add talent, right? We've learned with this Montreal group, like this is probably the group we'll see unless they find some smart buys here or there. I think there's enough for them to be competitive the whole year.
But that's where the progression comes, right? Because they did spend on talent. Kokoro is one of those guys. And outside of, you know, putting him in an open field with just a goalkeeper, he looks pretty coherent.
Dangerous. Don't put him on an open goal. That's a dangerous thing to do.
I mean, in training, you just got to kick. Like, you stand here, Kokoro. I'm going to kick the ball over your head. It's just going to be a goalkeeper. Make a decision and do it.
No, the goalkeeper is not the issue. The issue is when the goalkeeper is out.
It was baffling to me, his inability to figure out what to do in those situations. But like, Yankov doesn't have chemistry with anybody around him yet, or he shouldn't. If he does, that's an incredible adaptation. Bryce Duke and he are a little bit of an overlap. Opoku is hurt. Vilsain is filling in. Those wingbacks look like perfect fits for what they want to do. Can drop in, but are very good vertical threats in behind. Like, don't overcomplicate it. Huan, run straight forward, bro. You're faster than everybody else. We'll find opportunities to get you in good positions. Now, runners, make a good decision. I'm super juiced on Montreal. We always are. That feeling in the summer, a little bit of a, you know, sun on your face, nice drink, jazz festival, maybe a warm embrace. Sorry. I apologize.
Oh, my God. I wrote about Montreal in the column this weekend, and I gave them what I thought was a compliment, talking about how the fact that they didn't play particularly well against Inter Miami, against a heavily rotated Inter Miami squad. But they were still able to come out of there with 3 points because they were opportunistic, Montreal were, and because they have, I think, the resolve and the organization to hit on the break and to be good on attacking set pieces. And that's something we've seen in all three of their games so far. Now, Montreal fans being Montreal fans, they did not take that as a compliment. And that includes our good friend Patrice Bernier, who I'm guessing did not read the entire breakdown of it. But the reason to buy what is happening with Montreal thus far is that they have shown the ability to defend deep when they need to and to make it hard on other teams to break them down. And even when that stopped happening in that game against Inter Miami, because for about an hour in the middle of the game, Miami were, I'm not going to say were getting anything they wanted, but they were creating a lot of good chances and were not capitalizing on them. Even when that happened, Montreal didn't let go of the rope. This team last year, as soon as they gave up one good chance or two good chances, that was it. They were letting go of the rope and they were going to lose that game 3-0. So I think you got to give a ton of credit to Laurent Courtois for getting them to stay bought in, even when things aren't going great for them. And I hope that in the process of doing this, he can get his team to buy in on what we all want to see in terms of play style, which is the something as close as possible to what they were 2 years ago when they were the second best team in the Eastern Conference.
They're not the same team, so it's not a perfect comparison. I just always think back to the best MLS team I've ever watched is Bob Bradley's LAFC team for those 3 years, the soccer they played. The first like month of them existing was against the ball, counterattack, just getting results as they built. It doesn't always happen day one. So that's where the belief comes, as you talked about, of like, we have seen Laurent Courtois' Columbus Crew 2 teams for 2 years have moments where their goalkeeper passes midfield in possession and they play. Like, it's going to get there. He's going to try. But you're on the road to start the year in like one of these tough road trips. These road trips have killed other Montreal managers in the past. Yeah. They've never survived that. And by the end of the year, when they get let go, it points back to like, we never got started. So this is exactly what you want right now.
They have Chicago, DC, and Seattle for the final three games of the trip. Honest to God, if they just take one more point out of this road trip, I'm calling it a successful trip.
I mean, but to get the parade going, if they got 8 points after getting 8 points all last year in 17 games, as Courtois changes the playing style and the game model, it's pretty incredible. One of the things he said when we chatted a few weeks ago was, hey, Wilfred gave me something that nobody else had, which is confirming his belief that the only thing that really matters is us. Like, focus on yourselves, focus on your game, and everything else will follow. And it feels like they're building into that brick by brick. Portland Timbers tearing Yankee Stadium down brick by brick. No, I'm just kidding. But a big win for them, of course, Evander with the goal. Now, I'm having a hard time buying the Timbers right now, even with the Cabecita rumors. And CL Merlo just tweeted it's $5 million, three-year deal with an additional fourth year if they want to trigger it. That seems like a better deal than $15 million for Bertarame or $7 million for Cabecita. But a disjointed Rapids team in the first game in the Armas tenure, a DC team that battered them, that they got pretty fortunate to get out with a point, and then a New York City team that handed them the ball in the second half and a Golazo decided the day at Yankee Stadium. I'm not buying the Timbers just yet. I am buying a absolutely ideal, perfect, couldn't have written it up any better other than 9-point start for Phil Neville. To win your first game at home, to have the olive branch moment with Timbers Army and all the fans, the way he's like managing right now the public side of it, which was a little bit strained when he came in, I think has been A1. Do I think that means that Portland are for sure going to be this team the rest of the way? No. No. I the competition has not been at a super high level yet, in my opinion. What are the building blocks, though, Doyle?
Getting Evander back and having him look the way he looked in this game, that was huge for them. I'm not sure if Anthony, if he's real or not, but certainly it doesn't hurt that he's scoring a goal a week. The central defense, I thought, was going to be better, quicker. But both Zach McGraw and Kamal Miller have struggled. Nonetheless, 7 points from three games. You can't knock it too much. I'm not going to say it's all there. I'm with you. I think that they haven't been that great, but they've had the good fortune of playing two games at home and a third game against a team that is sort of, you know, in a death spiral in NYCFC. And sometimes that's what you need. And the hope, if you're a Timbers fan, is that Cabecita comes in and is a focal point for the attack and gives structure to the whole thing in the way that Giakoumakis does for Atlanta United. And then beyond that, they still need to figure out how to make the game more compact when they're not on the ball. Because if you watch them, even against the Rapids, they were getting stretched out and the spacing between their lines was huge, Portland's was. So I think I would worry going forward that as teams get sharper on the ball, Portland need to be more and more difficult to play against. And we haven't really seen that from them so far in these three games.
The one thing I'm hoping to see if Cabecita comes in as healthy as fit is I think he's a better to play into his feet and hold the ball than what you see from Giakoumakis. He's not going to create chances from that, but I think in terms of a focal point and staying compact, it's a player where you can play into his feet, he can hold the ball, and you can move as a unit, and the game gets less stress in possession. I also think there'll be more possession. Like, being able to play through him, now you have Moreno still on the wing. You can swap between Asprilla and Antony, which seems to be a good two options, where at times over the last few years, Asprilla has played because of lack of other options. And if Eric Williamson's healthy, now you have a whole choice of, you could become a decent possession team if that's what you choose to do. And I think there's the talent in this group to do it. That hasn't been the case for Portland really ever over the last few years. I don't know that's who Phil Neville wants to be, but I think the ability exists. But otherwise, I agree with you, Doyle, of like the moments where they are stretched, they look bad. They have gotten fortunate that teams haven't finished on them. And McGraw is not a high enough level center back to be like, yeah, we're just going to leave these two guys on an island and it's fine. Yeah. We don't need to deal with it. Now, against NYCFC, it got better as the game went along because they swapped Moreno to the left wing. That helped pin some of the pressure coming from NYCFC down the right side. It evened the game out a little bit for them because you always have to cover for Mosquera. Like, that's always going to be a factor. And this is without Bravo being there. I don't know how Bravo comes back into this team. I don't know how all of that works. But I think in general, if you're a Portland fan right now, you have to be positive because Paredes looks healthy. He looks good. That's another option in central midfield you haven't had over the last few years because Williamson's been out or Chará's been out, whatever it's been. So there's pieces here that haven't existed. I think Cabecita will work. I think he'll be a good signing, especially at the number we're talking about. That's a number of like, that's not a crazy MLS signing anymore. 5 million for a center forward to score 12 to 14 goals. Like, that's just the reality. Think about what we're talking about with Chicago or what we're talking about with Orlando or LAFC with some of these numbers for some of these other players. So I think he'll fit in and I think he'll be a good addition starting day one too, because he's in form, he's in season, coming from Liga MX is the right time. He's playing in CONCACAF competition. Like, it should work for them and they should be pretty positive.
It starts to make sense, especially with Mosquera, and again, without Bravo, because if you have both those fullbacks bombing up the wings, all of a sudden, center backs are just going to be playing 1v1 all the time. But Mosquera up the right, created a goal off that. He's impossible in those situations, in and around the edge of the 18-yard box. Tuck in for Moreno. Evander basically gets a free roll, often going into that left-hand side. Anthony or whatever winger, Dairon, fill in the blank, stretches it wide, and then Cabecita runs up top. Do you think he's a 12 to 14 goal scorer right now, Dave? Coming off a knee injury last year, all things considered, maybe not at his absolute peak at América, maybe Cruz Azul was that, but certainly that's in his locker somewhere.
Yeah, we talked about him coming to LAFC 2 years ago. We've talked about him coming to other teams in MLS. I wish it had happened sooner. I wish it had happened when he was 28 and at his peak of powers, but he is a player that when moderately healthy scores 7 to 8 goals in a tournament, which is half a year. Like, he will score double-digit goals for this team. I think this is a Portland team that creates chances. He's going to be a factor on set pieces. You've got Evander's service in there consistently being dangerous, and they create chances. Like, this is a team that has already created chances, and that's not having a player of that danger. Now, also, you've got center backs that have to deal with him. It's probably going to be two. So Moreno gets more opportunities. It's the game's easier for him. I think there's going to be even more opportunity for Evander to pass him in terms of getting higher up the field and being the one to get on the end of the play, like we saw Forsberg do for Red Bulls in their second goal in this game where Manuel set him up. That's not Cabecita's like best strength, but he's capable of it. And he's a good player. He's a high level player. So yeah, I would set the over under right now at 11.5, and I would take the over.
On the other side for New York City FC, it was a roller coaster this week and it was mostly down. Wasn't a lot of climbing going on. New York City FC and Nick Cushing had their home opener at Yankee Stadium. Again, terrible, terrible weather. Just so, so rainy. The opening day TIFO read, "Redemption starts today." 2023 was disappointing. NYCFC missed the playoffs. They didn't have much punch from an attacking perspective. And Nick Cushing spent the week basically talking about how they want to become dominant, be more aggressive. Quote, "I think this is a championship caliber team for sure." That was the buildup. The letdown was the game-winning goal from Evander, and it was more so the last 60 minutes or so where they took their foot off the gas, which was a hallmark of this team in 2023, like being a little bit overprotective of leads. Afterwards, and there's a lot of quotes to go through, and then Doyle, I'll let you off and running here. Keaton Parks said, "I think we have a lot of young guys that don't know how to play for results. We need to grind out bleeping results and not just bask in one-goal leads and bleep." And then Nick Cushing afterwards, playing defense in the media, in large part because the fans were so frustrated, there were chance of Cushing out at Yankee Stadium, said he's 150,000% responsible because he's the leader and 100% responsible for his players, and he'd tell the executives at the club that as well. Then went on to talk about how it hurts him to hear the Cushing out, but he accepts it. He's going to work even harder. And this comparison, this quote I thought was interesting, Doyle. Quote, "You can't be the NYCFC title-winning team." I inserted that. "You can't be the team you want to be just because you want to. You have to go through the process and the journey and the highs and lows of really fighting and coming together and learning. And then you become the championship team. You can't just be a team because you want to be. We're going through that process, and it's super painful." And I understand what he's saying. $25 million, but $25 million in young players that have to be integrated and perform up to the level. But man, the result and the results, three games, three losses for New York City, are very disappointing.
The point I would make to and Cushing's correct, right? Like you have almost every championship team goes through some stuff before they become a championship team. The difference is NYCFC, that group, you know, Maxi Morales, Sean Johnson, Alex Collins, Tati Castellanos, they went through that stuff over a 3-4-5 year period where they were uncompromising in how they played. It was almost Wilfred Nancy-esque in terms of how dedicated they were to using the ball. Like up until last season, I was saying like NYCFC have consistently been my favorite team in MLS to watch since about 2017. And it was because they were dedicated to that. They had the belief and the ability to execute it almost on a weekly basis. And sometimes that ended up in the Red Wedding where they would lose a big game or you know, on the wrong side of a lopsided scoreline. And annually they would lose in the playoffs, and it would be, I think, frustrating for the fans, but they went through it, always sort of refining their game model. And it feels like the opposite. This team, they'll get a one goal lead, and rather than stay committed to the game model and using the ball, they become a team that plays against the ball. And Nick Cushing actually said it like that. I read the whole press conference, all his quotes, and like he actually said as much in the press. Like, we have to, you know, we have to stop being the team that when they have a lead just sits on it. We have to actually stay who we are. And so he's aware of it, but at the same time, I feel like he contributes to that mindset when he brings on extra defensive midfielders or extra central midfielders. And he does that almost every time they have a lead. And in this case, when he was answering that question, like, why did you bring on more, you know, Justin Haack, who's just a pure defensive midfielder, or sometimes even a center back, in terms of, and drop an attacker, he called out Keaton Parks and Andres Perea for not being competitive enough and winning enough 50-50s in central midfield. So you add it all together, and it seems like a mess with veteran players calling out younger players, questioning the subs of the manager sort of pseudo calling out the veteran players, none of the young players progressing, the blueprint for how they want to play kind of being thrown in the toilet, even when it's provided really good returns over a half hour, and no ability to adjust positively in the second half. And it's gotten to the point, I mean, Nick Cushing's been there 67 games now, 1.2 points per game. That is barely above what Jason Christ did during that expansion season that cost him his job. I got to tell you, if they're not as good over this next 7-game stretch as they say they want to be, if they don't hit that number of whatever it is, you know, 15 points, something like that, it's hard to imagine that Nick Cushing will still be the manager come midseason.
Make it an 8-game stretch. This was the beginning of 7 of 9 at home for New York City. So home against Toronto, then two tough road games at Cincy, at Miami, then it's Atlanta, New England, DC, Charlotte, Colorado, all at home. We're talking about that season-defining stretch for Montreal that they've often fallen flat, and that was on the road. This one comes at home for NYC. The pressure is certainly on them to be the dominant, aggressive team and to get the results. Redemption starts tomorrow, I guess, or whenever that Toronto game is for New York City. Speaking of WAC, which is what we're in right now, man, the Chicago Fire. Just whack. Just the same thing from last year again. Three games so far. They draw by allowing stoppage time goal. They give up two self-inflicted goals against Cincy and lose. They give up a goal off a quick throw into Crew in stoppage time and lose that game as well. Shaqiri has three key passes in three games. Kuipers has five shots. He had three in this one, and look, Frank Klopas said it was much better. I'm not sure it was. The only single chance he had that was more than a snatching chance, he had a bad first touch on, but that wasn't a high percentage chance either. Dave, is this fire team same old, same old? Like, you know, what has been shall be, or could there be a turnaround coming?
Why would there be a turnaround if everything stayed the same? Like, I get know. They brought That's in Kuipers.
Rhetorical
but like,
question.
Yeah,
rhetorical
from a cultural question. Point of view, from top down, everything stayed the same, which doesn't put you in a place as players to say, oh, it hasn't been good enough. Like, we have to adjust what we do. And so, no, I don't think there's a huge turnaround coming for the Chicago team the way they're set up. I think at some point you start to look at Shaqiri as the most expensive player in the league is a culture setter, and he's clearly not doing it for himself. I'd be shocked if he was for the rest of this team, setting the proper culture from the top down. And I can't see it changing that much that quickly. And when you talk about Frank Klopas, like, he's obviously an emotional guy. He's well connected to that club. The league has changed since he was a head coach previously in ways which I think are outside of what he does. Like, we've never had a Frank Klopas team where you say, like, oh, this is a clear tactical identity. And what Doyle just talked about with NYCFC of, like, having a true identity and overplaying in ways to build something through tough moments, that's not been the case. So, yeah, this is a team that will probably scrap at the bottom of the playoffs. They were the last team out last year. They can do the same, if not a little bit better. It doesn't feel like there's any reason that there's going to be a sea change. The one hope was that Kuipers was so special that everything would just shift off his shoulders, because when there are singular talents, sometimes that happens. It's fairly rare in this league for that to be the case. And there's no reason to believe he's that guy. And that's not a knock on him. Like, to say he's not prime Carlos Vela or Miguel Almirón is not a knock on this player. And it doesn't even mean it's a bad signing.
Hey, all right. That's whack. This is a trade that just happened, according to Tom Bogert. Vancouver Whitecaps have acquired Canadian midfielder Ralph Priso in a trade with the Rapids. Let's go.
Get
Colorado
hyped.
Getting the first and third round pick, plus 150K in GAM add-ons, plus sell-on percentage. That is much lower than the price they paid to get him, which was Marc-Anthony Kay and, what, like 400K in GAM-ish, if I remember right. Priso, still just 21, gets a fresh start, second fresh start for him. And Colorado apparently are high on their draft pick in the super draft, Wayne Frederick. So Ralph Priso headed to Vancouver, had a good road win against San Jose this weekend. Ali Abed with a really, really nice goal. Says he wants more of that this year. Positive play, yes, but goal-scoring contributions, please and thank you. Let's end with CONCACAF Champions Cup. Round of 16, second legs coming up this week, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Quick thoughts here, Doyle. Let's start on Tuesday. Columbus-Houston. What do you think about this one? Columbus up 1-0. That late goal down in Houston changed the momentum of the tie. Seems like it's theirs to win.
It does. I think we would all be surprised by any other outcome here. Even without the late away goal, it would have been, we all would have picked Columbus to advance from this one. They weren't great this past weekend, but they're, you know, pretty good. And Houston's just incomplete, man. Like, this team is not, they had it all right there this winter to add to a team that was a trophy winning side last year, and they just didn't do it. And you can't go into MLS and you can't go into the MLS season like that and try to juggle multiple competitions. They're not quite cannon fodder, but they're not gonna win anything like this.
Especially with the injuries they're experiencing. By the way, I just love how Wilfred Nancy asks Mo Farsi to play wing back. I know he came off the bench, but the way he just sort of sits on that back shoulder in a blind area on the very farthest point he can before being offside, and just waits and trusts that the crew's possession and their ability to play with the ball will result in it finding its way to the weak side. Is really special to watch. Great goal for Farsi to win that game for the crew. Dave, between Philly, Orlando, and Cincinnati, who has the best chance of turning around their tie and winning in Mexico? Philadelphia, Pachuca, 0-0, of course. Same for Tigres and Orlando. Monterrey got the one goal. Brandon Vasquez special. Do any of these three teams move on?
Yeah, Philadelphia does. And I think if you're an MLS for CONCACAF person, which I don't think a lot exists anymore, you have to hope they do, because they have the easiest route. And as much respect as you want to give to Herediano, it's not facing Club America or Tigres or Monterrey in the next round. So they're going to be, if they were able to get through past Pachuca, the lone team that won't face a Liga MX team in the next round for an MLS side trying to win it. They have experience at high levels as well. It sounds like Carranza will be available to some extent for this game. It's also the most winnable one of the three you just named. Pachuca are the team that have the most, or there's the most opportunity. I think for Philly and for Cincinnati, they're both going to play against the ball. You're playing at altitude. You have to get a goal early. Like, you cannot leave it to the 75th minute, especially with the way these two teams are playing so far this season. But I have a ton of confidence in Philly and not playing this weekend, even though you warmed up and got ready and were mentally there, probably doesn't hurt you as well.
I think that was a blessing for them in Champions Cup. Meanwhile, for Orlando, like, don't let Tigres score first. I know that sounds like the most blindingly obvious thing of all time, but if Tigres score and Orlando have to open up and go for it, historically, that's where we've seen teams get their medicine, so to speak, in Mexico. How about Miami-Nashville, Doyle? 2-2 in the first leg at the Schaffelberg special, and Miami came roaring back this week. Hany Mukhtar got a new designated player deal. He, Carlos Gil, and Denny Bawanga all signed long-term packs to stay in MLS. Who you favor in Miami-Nashville?
I favor Miami. I think that they will find a way to get this done, in part because teams keep just packing the box against them, and Messi and Suarez and Busquets and Jordi Alba have seen that before. And, you know, three times now, Galaxy, Nashville, and the first leg, and even against Montreal over the weekend, like, teams just put numbers behind the ball and kind of stopped playing, and Miami figured out a way to create chance after chance after chance. And that is how Gary Smith teams play, right? They're not going to go out and try to play through Miami's press, though. To be fair to them, they did a good amount of that last year in the League's Cup final. Now, a lot of that came from Walker Zimmerman being healthy and excellent, and Dax McCarty was phenomenal during that whole tournament. I'm not sure Zimmerman's going to be able to play. He's got a knock, and obviously Dax is gone. And I think that limits what Nashville are able to do with the ball. I would be surprised if they found a way past Miami in this one, even with Messi ostensibly less than 100%.
It was also all at home for Nashville. Like, they were playing with a crowd and an atmosphere at their back, even against Miami when they played against the ball, that we just don't see Nashville play on the road. At the same time, Miami leaves gaps. The reality, and we've talked about it now for a month, is like, look what happened for Montreal. Now, that wasn't against Miami's A team, but it was a lot of it defensively and in midfield. And, like, there's opportunities and there's mistakes. Hany Mukhtar is capable of taking advantage. Sam Surge is. You're hoping as well. Tyler Boyd being on the field keeps a little possession for you in transition moments as well. And Shaq Moore came off the bench and at least played with some good energy in the last game. It's not set up well for Nashville, but it's possible. And it's, I think, at times manageable compared to, like, going down to Mexico and trying to deal with altitude and the team in a different form and all these other things. This is a bit more natural for Nashville. This is a team now they faced in high level moments over the last year.
I mean, would you be more surprised by Nashville getting through? Yeah, the set piece is a big one. Would you be more surprised by Nashville getting through or by Orlando getting past Tigres?
Orlando.
Yeah, me too.
I mean, anytime Elvil Khan fill in the blank club going down there, that's going to be shocking to me that they win. Last question for you guys here. Dave, if I made you the Galaxy penalty taker, do you think you would do better than their current crop of?
No, I think it probably, I think it'd be right on. Listen, I wouldn't be worse. I think I'd be as bad as the ones they have right now. I'd put it on frame and I'd miss every single time. So yeah.
All right, there you go. There you have it. Galaxy trying to figure it out, but a fun game on Sunday from them. That's our Match Day 4 review. Thank you so much for tuning in every single week to hear us ramble on about soccer. And now with one final embrace for the two of you and Anders, I bid farewell. Adios, everybody. We'll see you on Thursday.
We'll be right back.